every hatchling sprints across the cool sand, yet only one will become the next world.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and Mark Vincennes is here. That introduction music is Mark's creation, and he will tell us about how he did this a little later in the program. So right now we're going to hear a poem from Mark's new book. He has astonished the world for years with his extraordinary inventions, and this is no disappointment. Let's have an opening poem, please.
Sure, Grace. Thank you so much for having me. This is called Daddy's Shrunken Heads. Daddy's shrunken heads lay there, right next to his pipe rack, and reminded me of those plastic trolls whose hair you could braid like a Viking's. But they all had these grimaces, clenched eyes, as if they had lost their heads in a last act of pleasure or pain. Hard to tell, the lines get blurry there. Later, Mummy hid them, those telling three heads that stared at the world from inside a coconut. Daddy advised me they were three of his ex-business partners, one from Russia, one Brazil, the third, a little fella who grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, somewhere in Islington in North London.
Mark Vincennes, what a one to open with, because first of all, it is wild, it's dark, it's funny, and it showed you had quite an unusual beginning. It says quite a bit about your household. And tell us about the book. Tell us about this new book.
Well, No More Animal Poems is a book about animal extinction, overconsumption, to a certain degree also climate change. It is written in various forms, some prose poetry, some lineated poetry, some possibly even verging on fiction. And I tried my best to put myself inside the mind of many creatures and living things on this planet and try and see things from their perspective in many ways. Of course, bearing in mind that I'm a human, I had to have some human interaction everywhere as well. But you'll see it builds on itself. It's set up like a menu. Beginning with, the table of contents is like a menu. So different sections are based on various fictitious recipes.
Very innovative. We would expect nothing less from you. So you had this obsession for a while, and there are intimations of it in all of your work with science and ecology and the climate. But when exactly did it start to turn into this fantastical realism? How long has it been in the making?
That's a good question.
10 years?
Yeah, probably something like that.
I know you have, you're putting out something all the time, so this might have been background music while you produce something else, for all we know. Because Mark, I have to tell them, is a multilingual poet, fiction writer, translator, editor, musician, and artist, all true. He's published over 50 books of poetry, fiction, and translation, and this just came out. This is brand new. So let us have two poems together to get a bunch of Mark.
Well, actually, Daddy's Shrunken Heads continues. That was part one that I read earlier. So I'll now read part two and three. I would stare longingly into their distant pasts. I knew the Russian hailed from Stalingrad and had once been a window cleaner, and the Brazilian half Swedish, and prior to being a business fellow had dabbled in the arcane arts, a lover of the Ouija board and the tarot card, it was said. The Englishman was a man of letters by the shape of his nose. I could tell he had been a fine poet. In fact, the last four lines from his very last poem popped into my head from time to time. Stop the presses, roll out the stresses, let me be the squirrel to your acorn, the inflamed enjambment of caresses, the knees to your bees in a hailstorm. And part three. Strangely, between those early days and those of the three heads' demise, the Englishman had become a disreputable chap dealing in exotic insects. The Russian fellow ended up at the ends of the earth on an ocean freighter destined for the turquoise shallows of Borneo, and the Brazilian had been hijacked mid-sea. It was hardly a Titanic moment, more a strafe of irony that they all landed on what they thought was a deserted beach. And lucky for me, they smelled of cinnamon and vanilla, of toasted garlic and onions, hand-rolled Havanas, and Mummy's chicken salad. That was until Mummy tossed them in the trash chute, along with Daddy's collection of pornography and a purple evil eye that I seem to recall came from the island of Crete. But then again, I may be wrong.
You know, the macabre wit and the true compassion. That's an interesting combination. You have such a European sensibility at the root of your work. There's classicism and there's popular culture that creeps in. So this speaks of your unusual beginnings. And so tell us where you were born and how you got here.
Oh, wow. That's a long story. my mother was British. My father, Swiss. I was born in Hong Kong. I grew up in Hong Kong in the United Kingdom. Also spent three years at a monastery boarding school in Switzerland before coming to the United States, and then finishing high school and going to Duke University. And after that, working at an offshoot of USAID or USAID, and then eventually ending back in Europe, starting my own design company and actually also working in China for close to 10 years, all the while writing. And then at a certain stage, realizing that I no longer could be in the business rat race. And there were so many things that I was just ethically opposed to that I decided to pack it in and basically become a professional writer and translator. And that's here I am today.
Exactly what you did. And you have more than 50 books. Is the Swiss connection the reason that you translated the poet Klaus Mertz?
It is. It is. In a period of time, I lived in Iceland and I went to the National Library to see, you know, what they had in their poetry collection. And I came across a Swiss poet who I thought, maybe I should start translating this. And so I did. And it was published. And I have been translating since. I think I now have done 12 translations books. I think that's correct.
Audible Blue, right?
Audible Blue. And then actually I did two more of Klaus Mertz's books this last year. One was In the House Still Light, which was his last collection of poems. And the other was is called Dreaming Jack, which is a lyrical novella.
Alive?
Yes, Klaus is still around. He's in his, I would say, mid-80s now.
So you were able to communicate with him while doing this?
Oh, yes. We're good friends.
Oh, that's so great. And it won the Massachusetts Book Award.
The Audible Book Award, yes.
For translated literature. Let's have two more poems from the book No More Animal Poems.
This one's called The Rhinoceros Affair. Even after the party, after being plied with all manner of quaint aphorisms, I still hungered for her touch. I couldn't resist spreading the word that she was the best ever to grace my ramshackle cabins. And as I told the others, she made my blood simmer, broil and roil. Of course, the theory goes, all the magic came from that single majestic horn, sharpened to an immaculate point. There were those who enviously wanted to lop it off. Others figured it might be useful later and considered renting a warehouse down on the docks, so whichever parts would be harvested and sold might be hastily transported anywhere in the known world. Late in the early hours after the last nightcap, her legend still circulates the empty halls. And this one is called Into the Unseen. And it goes deeper than you could imagine, deeper still than the very last layer, for there is no full stop. The butcher bird scries these pastures since the day the sky reflects in the water. She knows each cell is linked to one another, deep to their eternal end, all those circles of infinity bound together in a single forever of voles and beetles and crickets and parasites.
Oh, so much meaning braided into so much language so easily. I really feel that there is no one, well, of course, no one writes like anyone else either, but you bring forth such a depth of language, and you make it funny and sad and sweet and meaningful and powerful. Is that easy?
Easy.
Does it come naturally?
Relatively, I would say, yeah.
That's the way you talk. So I think that it's part of your personality. I think it's the intelligence is there, but the personality is absolutely yours and is on the page. I'm very interested in the title of the book, which is a little enigmatic and not a statement at all. So what did you do with us there?
Well, actually, it really came about when a friend of mine who's also a critic once said to me, I really like your animal poems. You should write more of them. And so I thought about that for a while. And then, as I'm apt to do, I did a lot of research about the state of extinction and endangerment. And I really went very deep into that. In fact, there is that extinction list at the back of the book, which I actually did manually line by line myself, mostly from the red list, which is, shall we say, at least the most accepted current indicator of extinction and endangerment, bearing in mind, of course, that many, many animals have lived that we never named. So the title No More Animal Poems is really, you know, if we don't stop and think and try and change what we're doing to the environment and with our overconsumption and so on, we won't have any more animal poems.
Right.
From that point of view.
Also, it's full of animal poems.
Exactly.
Which is a perfect thing for Mark Vincent. He comes from within and without. The inside person and the outside person are the same person. We just get different views all the time of everything. And he's also an editor. His books include The Pearl Diver of Irumani, Spells for the Wicked, All the Tricks of Language, Ironclad. Those are the recent ones of more than 50. So let us hear some more.
This is called Lesser Known Creatures of the Deep. A globster appeared on a shore on New Year's Day. Children and wild dogs could be seen walking back to town with giant tentacles, barbs, parts of fins, shiny scales, or in Ammon's case, an eye, one of four, around the size and color of his sister's newborn head. He weighed it in his hands and decided it was a little heavier than a cantaloupe. With a bundle of string, Ammon fashioned a halter for the eye and took to wearing it on his back like an eyeball knapsack. That evening, as he and his friends were futzing around near the derelict plutonium plant, tossing empty bottles into broken windows, the eye started to weep salty tears. "Why do you think she's crying?" Momo asked. He had a great smear of dirt across his forehead. His mutt, Machiavelli, had something in his mouth that looked like mint jelly but smelled like rotting fish. A great dollop of sticky liquid ran down Ammon's legs. They all surrounded the knapsack eye perched on top of a drum marked toxic waste. Ammon, Momo, Musty, and Machiavelli stared in disbelief. The eye appeared to be blinking. "Could it be a Charybdis?" Momo said. "A Froken?" asked Musty. But Ammon knew only the Muscimo had those fine eyelashes.
Eyeball backpack. Doesn't everyone have one of those? Okay, give us some music from Mark Vincennes, which accompanies this work, and he'll tell us about it.
in each and every flower. And believe it or not, there's a violin playing here on this rainy day in Port Emily, in those slicked cobbled alleys by the docks that lead down dead ends into courtyards of cracked homes, through dying gardens of hydrangeas, across drying lawns and drier soil, and through that sparse, thorny underbrush. And everything seems to be fine in black and white until we stumble across the carcass of a whale and three of her offspring groaning in the streets with their blood and blubber wail, with their sigh and foam, with eyes that stare from far below as the man hacks the camera pans to the soft underbelly of a mythical creature, another of these fancy-footed with a heavy debt to pay, or so they say, dribbling their sob stories over whiskey and rye. Jack Daniels will work at a pinch, but be certain, there's nothing much more certain than this, even though there's more to be said.
I don't know what to say. This could be a terrifying children's book. It could be an opera. It comes from some place no one else has ever been. Did it start as a dream, or do you dream awake?
I do both. I do both. Actually.
Yes. Yes. Mark, what made you the courageous person you are? Because it takes courage to do that. It takes courage to have an eyeball with fine eyelashes still blinking. So is it because you don't think there's anything to lose? Because nothing's at stake? Because you already have a reputation? Because if you don't do it, no one will? What in the world drives you?
I'm a big proponent that writing can be many things. Of course, poetry can be many things. It can be a song, a sonic experience. It can be, of course, a story as a song. My goal has always been to explore the possibilities as deeply as I can, not just in the form, but also in the subject matter. So I do my best to try and picture myself from various different characters that appear in my work. And I just go with that. And that takes me in more often than not, even someplace where I don't suspect. And that is kind of the greatest joy of this journey.
There you have it. There you have it. You're an archaeologist of the unconscious, and you just keep digging, and you're not afraid to pull it up and present it. But what interests me as well are your various forms and shapes on the page. Because as you mentioned, you might have a manicured set of stanzas, you might have couplets, you might have prose poetry, and we'll talk about the music in a bit. But how do you decide to hold your art for each different poem?
It basically chooses it itself. Occasionally, I used to be much more strict with my form than I am now.
Always been a craftsman for sure.
But now I actually let the form sort of dictate what it wants to be. Occasionally I'll write a lineated poem that I then think, actually this works better as a prose poem because of the internal rhyme, maybe, or just because it is just a touch more narrative than the lyrical poem, for example. But then again, I like to play with mediums that are in between as well. In one of my recent books, Ironclad, I don't know if you have a copy of that one, Grace.
I do.
That one basically explores itself in the sort of schematic of an archaeological dig of a, shall we say, civilization that may or may not have existed. And so you discover the work as you read through the book in the different layers of the substrata, discovering fragments of what your origins were. And it's all framed in a sense like an archaeological dig is being presented at a museum.
It's a fine book. It's a fine book for sure. Do you never awaken and said, I can't write today?
Not anymore. Not anymore.
Because why?
I have very varied ways of writing. So I like writing by hand. Sometimes I use the typewriter. Sometimes I just sit at my desk and write into my computer. Other times I like to sit in a cafe or have music going in the background. All sorts of different ambiances and locales I find inspire different aspects of writing.
Never thought of that. I usually make my students get up and sit in different seats when they come back into the room. And I know perspective and geography has something to do with point of view, but I never actually thought of going to a cafe to see if I could get more out. The thing is that writer's block is just ego energy, I think. And I think over the years, you have a cachet that gives you an infinite permission. Don't you think that just the recognition and the energy that is like, I know some people that write from 8 to 2 every day. Do you do such a thing?
Less so nowadays, but I always try and get at least 3 hours of writing in a day.
I love that.
It depends. It depends what time of day though, on what's going on. But generally speaking, nowadays it's more in the afternoons now.
Don't our young poets, do you know anybody that is that disciplined anymore? It seems that that's a way of life.
I mean, many poets, of course, are also academics. So this is the other part of their life. And I've heard plenty of my professor friends tell me, that they can't wait till summer comes around so they can finally do some writing again. You know?
I think you're one of 3 poets who never actually taught in a university full time.
That's
right. And that was Robert Bly, Franz Wright, and Mark Vincennes. And you've made an empire outside of it. I don't think that could have happened if you had to slug through the administrative papers. I agree. You made a good choice. Let's have 2 more poems.
This one is called Thus Spake the Other Bears. We scrounged and scavenged in a frenzy of rinds and skins and fatty substances scraped from the underbelly of an oily plastic bag that melted in the mouth and infused everything with a shimmering front palate umami. Toyo says there were once other bears here on our island, and they swam like sea otters from crag to outcrop, and they dined on roe and the flesh of their trout mothers who, in all their spawning, had plenty to spare. And so the others perched above the most compact yet luxuriant waterfalls, who snatched the fish as they surged upward, spring-bound to their maker. But of course, the others would say, the fish they devoured still lived on in the forest and within the creek down into the valley and out into the vast ocean where we shall all finally sink. And someday, with good fortune, we too shall serve up some as yet unknown species, a dark, sticky, liquefied sun.
So let's have another.
Sure. This from toward the end of the book, before the extinction list appears, is called Quantum Entanglement, a Cosmic Rift. The space between you and them doesn't exist. They may be the mirror of each other, or they may be not what we think. Perhaps they are made of a spooky action at a distance, or maybe cause and effect occur at the same time. Surely space and time are the same, says our world turtle. Do we need the entire breadth of the universe? Asks a solitary snail. The universe doesn't exist, says the crow, plucking at the entrails of half a shaggy monkey. Isn't the last state always an exciting instant? Asks the sunflower. The air is suddenly thick with clouds, and the eel says, isn't the universe just atoms and particles? It troubles us all, says the crow soulfully, staring at his talons. Deep inside matter, we're all fuzzy and undefined. He reminds, a wave of probability descends like a rain cloud.
Sounds folkloric, fairy tale, Grimm's fairy tale, philosophy, science. And also, I think the couplets contain a tumult that I feel in the book. I mean, you're very witty and wry and ironic at times. You remind me of Villon sometimes. But then there is this sadness that I think is contained in form. And I think couplets keep it buried so that the information is containable and that you can handle it better. That's what I get from your couplets. Because it's too hard to hear, really. You have to put a constraint on it.
Mm.
I feel that. And I feel that there's so much imagination here. How much research did you do? Because you couldn't just name, we know the names of monkey and rhinoceros, but you couldn't know all these facts without research.
Well, I am a big animal lover anyway. I have a very close relationship with my two dogs, for example. But I've always been very interested in the animal kingdom ever since I was a little boy, really. Mm. So I have all that, you know, past with it. But yes, I did do extensive research, particularly on the scale of, climate change and the environment as well, just to, you know, be as up to date as I could, because I think that's important.
I know. And you must have done a little of this while you were doing everything else in your life, because I know you continue to be the editor of Mad Hat, and then you publish New American Writing, and your productivity goes on and on. So this had to be done in bits and pieces.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always have several books going on at the same time.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
So
that's true.
I move from one to the other, depending on, you know, how my mood strikes, basically.
I recommend that. That's called steam valve writing, where you get a little more steam coming out of that. When that one dies down, you go to the other one. So you must have a lot of spiral notebooks around and a couple of computers at the same time.
I do. This is called Crab God of Sand, Ocean, and Sky. In a dark, seething fury, the god wades through their oceanic green, through churning shale and froth, where minnows swirl around their spiny legs and piperfish nip at their eye stalks. Mm. Yes, they know how to calm their seas, to tend the waves and maelstroms, to direct the leaping of the faithful flying fish. And it goes without saying, to grasp the undying love tentacles of the great cosmic squid. Beneath the giant ferris wheel burdened with the bounties of limitless two-legged, landlocked, sand-gazing voyagers, a rattling tumor coughs thick, dark fumes on the beach. From its grim posterior, long black tentacles of disgrace splash through the shallows until they melt into the foam. Seagulls and tuna are caught in a frenzy of tar and feather and pitch as herring are whipped to the surface, fully clawed. The kittiwake screams and swoops in, and the blackened shrimp rise and fall in a strange, dark, undulating spume. The ocean here smells primordial, as if she is escaping to her erstwhile self. The crab god swallows mouthfuls of water and brine. Waves retreat all along the shore. And then there is a pause of undying silence, a pause so long it seems time itself has ended. Before the storm, the sand turns to clear glass. After the storm, there is nothing but fragments and fleas.
You know, you do the opposite of transformation. No, you do transformation, but you transcend in an upside down way. You always begin with light And then you show what comes from light, which is dark. And you always, when you end, it's like, you better check my beginning. That's what I get when I get to the end of your poem. Check my beginning, because it's just all part of a cycle. But you do end with dark sometimes, and you do end with devastation, and you do end with clouds and rain, but it's not what we're left with, because you begin with life and light. You just turn transformation and transcendence upside down, it seems to me, which is like you.
It's not in my plan, really.
Upside down transcendence. You can put it on your tombstone. I said it. Now, these got rave reviews. That No More Animal Poems got rave reviews. And there's a note on all these pages of accolades, which says No More Animal Poems will be available as audiobook performed by the author, accompanied by neo-progressive ambient folk, funk, and spoken word album. No More Animal Songs is performed by Mark Vincennes and the Supersonic Orchestra. And the first single, Swell, was just released, I think.
It's just about to be.
Okay. How did you do it? Do you have a studio?
I have a little studio at home. I did some demo work here. But I'm very lucky to have a friend who runs a very important studio, actually, in mixing and production and engineering in the rock scene, really. But also have folk scene as well. They have produced and mixed, people like The National, the band, and Moby, and Jonsi of Sigur Rós in Iceland, and many others. So I was very lucky. This is a childhood friend of mine, and I asked him if they would give me some time to help me record some pieces, and we started like that. And we meet up probably once every 3 months now, and spend a week in the studio or something like that.
Oh, a week. And I guess he has no other neo-progressive ambient folk funk partner at all. This must be a first for him. It must keep him going. And so it was done in a weekend?
No. I would say, the long track, which is the 28-minute piece, which is based on the poem in No More Animal Poems, World Turtle, Mother Goose, Cosmic Elephant, is the full narration, but also accompanied by a host of studio musicians, along with myself. I also played some instruments on the album, and I composed most of the music.
What instruments, Mark?
A percussion, synthesizer, violin, flute, various harmonies, background vocals as well.
See, I always knew you came from the star planet. I always knew you came with. Nobody else could learn it all here. Let's have a final poem.
This is called The Golden Anchovy Grooves. Once this fishing town was rife with their shoals, a mating ground for humpbacks and their royal moray foray, piperfish grazing the sandbank like angry wisps of the deep, and the anchovy spawning and dying in all their glories. Hardly a bucket or pail was left unfilled. You could scoop your hand into the ocean, and there was your live catch, dozens of them wriggling in your palm. They were salted and oiled, dried and smoked, some marinated in a tomato and garlic, were to be the main course for the annual raffle of the Gurundia Tabernacle Choir. After the feast, the bones were discarded all along the shores, evidence of the majestic gestures of the evening before. When Tomas spat out the bones, he discovered something entirely unexpected, namely a little plastic name tag with his name engraved on it in a somewhat juvenile script. On the back, a missive. His friends took it as something of a fortune cookie. It said, "Although we die at your hands, we live forever in your reef." And then it said, "How do you think you'll swim out of this?" Years later, before he died, the golden anchovy approached Thomas and guided his salty soul straight into the deep.
magic, fairy tales, prophecies, philosophy. Mark Vincennes' visions have fortified humanity and our culture and prolonged the animals, I hope. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank our funding from people such as the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, friends of the program, Avidesha Shani, Natalie Canavore, Young Ki Kim Reno, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin is our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.
And why do black holes even exist? Look deep into the quantum and let us know when you have your decimal point or that faint integer responding to your missive.